It's your boy Jack Slack coming at you midweek with the Boycast. Just popping in for a quick one. I've been a bit tardy. I haven't watched one. I haven't watched all of the One Championship card. I haven't watched my boy John Haggerty defending his kickboxing title because honestly, that's like watching, I don't know, I was going to say like a great kickboxer without his kicks, but currently we've got Tenshin Nasukawa and Yoshiki Takei, two of the former best kickboxers in the world, just squared off in the boxing ring to hype a fight between the two of them for a world title in boxing. Crazy, eh? But what I did watch was Beterbiev versus Bivol 2, and I just wanted to chat about that a bit today, lads, because I thought it was brilliant. I've chatted with a few people about the scoring of it now, how they saw it. I wasn't scoring it as I went along. I was going on sort of vibes, but I think one of the reasons it was so good was that it was one of those fights, as we always say, fights that move in phases. They've got like acts. There was an act one where Bivol looked good. There was an act two in the middle where Beterbiev looked great. And then there was an act three where Bivol pulled it back. And, you know, there were the movement between the acts weren't so obvious. There was like Bivol and then Beterbiev started to come on, and there was a sort of round where you could have given it even either way. And then there were those sort of transitional rounds where it wasn't so clear who won them. So it was interesting talking to people about their scores. And of course, this was also such a clear-cut style clash that your scoring is also going to be affected by what you're seeing, as in what your eye picks out most. If you want to see someone cutting the ring and throwing big bombs, hurting people into punches, you're going to score everything that Beterbiev does. If you are looking for the jabs and for the clean outside fighting, you're going to score Bivol even when he's hitting the gloves. And I think, you know, as a viewer, don't beat yourself up for your biases. Enjoy them. You're not out there scoring split decisions in obvious clear-cut fights and picking up money possibly from betting on it. You're just having fun. But there's so much cool stuff to talk about from this fight, and I think that a good place to start is double jab. Oh my god, double jab. I'm always, every single week, double jab. Do you know what this guy could benefit from? A double jab. Do you know what this give this guy trouble? Double jab. But this was just both men, both completely different fighters, both made use of the double jab to an enormous extent in this fight. Bivol's double jab, I really like it. It's kind of like what Holyfield used to do, which is pump two hard jabs from the same spot in the ring. It's not traveling with the double jab. It's not jabbing from where you're standing and then stepping with it, which is something that Beterbiev did, which we'll talk about in a minute. It's literally get in range so that your jab would touch them, pump it out, and then pump it again so that if they've parried it, whether they overparry it, whether they're moving back to their guard, you've got a good chance of just going through their hand on the second one. And you've seen Bivol against Canelo, he was doing like triple jabs. But that double jab, it works so well. He just gets in range to throw one jab and he throws two hard jabs instead. Without the intention of backing Beterbiev up, it's just double jab to land the second jab. And then Beterbiev had great success with the double jab head body. And the way that he was throwing it was that he got close enough to throw his jab out in front of him so that it would basically just touch on the end of it from where he was standing. He wouldn't move his feet on the first one. And then as he pulled his jab back, he would step into a nice long, wide stance side on and jab the body. So his weight would fall down into it with the step. And that body jab did a lot of work for him. That was what was slow. Well, that was part of what was slowing Bivol down towards the middle portion of the fight, because they were saying, oh, he's not throwing a lot of body shots yet. And you're going, well, I think I count the body jab as a body shot. Certainly when you're stepping in behind it and you're pushing down on the guy's diaphragm or solar plexus like that. First couple of rounds, I think you'd have a hard time scoring them for Beterbiev. They were where Bivol did some really good work. Because he just looked so fast. His hands looked so fast and his feet looked really fast. And I was, you know, I've seen a billion fights. And still by the end of the second round, I was going, oh, what if Beterbiev never catches up to him? And then, of course, round four, suddenly he's standing in front of him and you're going, oh, yeah. That's what happens. No one moves the same in round 5, 6, 7 that they do in round 1 and 2. But that's the excitement of the fight. You forget this shit. So what Beterbiev was trying to do was the interesting thing about Bibble is that he, for all his reputation as a great ring general, and the proof is in the pudding, he's done very well as a ring general, but he tends to circle one way exclusively. So through this whole fight, if you put it on fast motion for 12 rounds, because watching through VLC player is the best way to watch any kind of fight, particularly expensive ones. If you put it on 1.5 times speed, four times speed, yakety sack speed, you're going to see these guys circle the ring clockwise about 100 times. They didn't circle the ring counterclockwise once, because Bivol is always circling to his left, which is interesting because Beterbiev is good with his left hand, but he favours his right hand. His right hand is the one that does a lot of the damage. So Beterbiev throughout this fight is trying to get Bivol towards the ropes, and when Bivol circles out to his left, he's trying to time the right hand. And I could write a fucking thesis on just his use of the right hand in this fight. This was a lesson in trajectory, how trajectory makes a difference. His punches never looked sloppy. They always looked good, powerful, not like he was going to hurt his arm or shoulder or wrist on it. But it was the difference between the elbow open, so coming across the top of the shoulder, coming over the opponent's elbow, bringing his elbow over the top of Bivol's elbow and throwing like an overhand or a right hook, and keeping the elbow closed and punching up the middle, and where Bivol was for all those punches. So one of the great tricks of ring cutting, or one of the great tricks of like herding punches, is that throwing a big overhand as the opponent circles to your left is a great way to crack them. Or at least you hit their guards. I mean, if you watch this fight, there's loads of punches that he lands on Bivol's guard and punches Bivol's hand into his head. He's throwing hard. But that's like the surface level of herding punches. You throw a round punch as the guy circles so that you can stop him with it. You slow him down. You can then start following up. Or, you know, if you hit him, he's really going to feel it. The level above that is that you try and time the, you show them that, and then you try and time the straight punch in front of your shoulder. So it doesn't have to come to your center line. You've shaved a little bit off the path of the punch. You throw your straight punch in front of your shoulder just as they're circling into that line. So if you square up and put your right arm out in front of you, but right in front of your shoulder, not towards your center line, that's where you're going to hit him. And Beterbiev was looking for that throughout the fight, landed some really good ones. And then, of course, you can go body and head too. So he was throwing the wide right to the body. And when he threw the wide right to the body, he got low. He got low, he threw it wide, and it looked like those photos of baseball pitchers when they go real low along the floor and they got their legs completely wide and they're bending down, almost touching the dirt. I don't know what kind of pitch that is, but there's numerous famous photos like that. And that's how he'd throw his wide right. And then sometimes he'd keep the elbow tight and throw it to throw the right straight instead. And just that elbow open, elbow closed on the right hand, the messing with trajectory, it's enough. And then we can go a level deeper on the iceberg, or a level higher on the use of this. So the circular punch comes over behind the guard, the straight punch comes inside the guard. But there were also instances in this fight where he moved to make his straight punch come over the guard. So he'd move, he'd get ahead of Bivol circling towards the right, or when Bivol changed direction, he'd try and throw the right straight over the arm. And there was also a really nice one in round four, maybe. He does a bump, as they used to call it with Dom Cruise, where the back foot comes up to a little bit, and the lead foot kicks out to the left slightly in front. So you're going around the opponent to your left. And he threw the overhand so that it came inside Bivol's gloves. So the punch that would be going over is now coming inside. And that's a real trick. Like, if you can throw hooks so that they come through the front of the opponent's guard, that's really tricky to deal with because they're so short and you can't really parry a hook. You know, if a straight punch comes through the center of your guard, you parry it. If a hook comes through the center of your guard, the elbow's right on top of you, basically. So it's hard to do anything about it. So a great example would be Mike Tyson's D'Amato shift, or whatever you want to call it, where he'd angle out to his left into a southpaw stance, and he'd throw a right uppercut, like what is now his lead hand, southpaw. Right uppercut or right hook, and it would come straight through the front of the opponent's guard because he'd have taken that quick angle. So just those things were phenomenal from Beterbiev. Just Bivol kept circling that one way, so he'd keep pitching overhand, straight, body, head. Sometimes he'd step with his right hand and do a little combination, southpaw. Both men switched to southpaw at points in this fight. That would have been unthinkable 40 years ago, 30 years ago, they'd have their coaches would have been abandoning their corner. They'd go like, if you're not taking it seriously, I'm not either. They'd have left. So that's how we've cut, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, but also attitudes have significantly changed to switch hitting in boxing. Which brings us on to the pep step, which Bivol was doing a little bit early on. Circle off to his left, level his feet out, and jump off his left leg. So he's throwing like a southpaw left straight. Look up the pep step. I did a video on it ages ago. But it was Willie Pep's main move. He'd circle to his left, bringing his feet level, so that he's side skipping more than like sidestepping in his stance. And then he'd rebound off his left foot into a left straight. And Bivol did this a couple of times early on, but then he was really taking risks with the number of overhands that Beterbiev was throwing in. But then when the table started to turn again, when Beterbiev started slowing down, Bivol went straight back to that pep step because he could get off a good punch with it. But the first change of momentum comes in round three, I think, maybe round four. Beterbiev throws the overhand, just sort of clips Bivol behind the guard, but Bivol stops moving. And then Beterbiev steps in with an overhand and a left hook to the body, and he lands his first good body shot that's not a jab. And that's when you went, oh, that's the point of chasing him down and throwing the overhand over and over again, or the right straight, and trying to catch him with something big so that he stands still and you can get to the body a bit more. And the middle rounds were all Beterbiev. And then Bivol started to get back in it. What I will say is Bivol did a great job in this fight. I think definitely better than last fight. Even though he was being run ragged through these early rounds, running along the ropes, his back was to the ropes the entire time, which is part of why Beterbiev is so comfortable just pitching a big overhand over and over again as Bivol circles. Because did you ever see him have trouble getting Bivol to the ropes? And a lot of people do. So he was just using the jab and the double jab and the jab, jab to the head, body jab, that double jab, brilliantly backing Bivol up, because Bivol doesn't want to stand there and trade. He picked his times to, but he doesn't want to generally. So he'll give ground, and then they're on the ropes. But I will say Bivol did a great job of, once or twice around, he would circle back out to the center of the ring, and he would do that spam combination that I joke about, but it is really good for him. Jab, right straight to the body, come up with the left hook, like long left hook, so it's slappy, it's not like a pure left hook, and then a right straight to the head. Four punches. And he's done it so many times that he can rattle them off fast as you like. And it always gets the attention of the crowd and the judges. And he always makes sure it happens in the center of the ring. And he sits down on the blows. I'm sure he wants to hurt Beterbiev. They were, in the first fight, it was important that he was able to maybe not stand toe-to-toe with Beterbiev, but he was able to say, look, I can hurt you. But it always had this extra layer of making sure it was really seen in the middle of the ring. He wasn't... You know, a great example would be Hagler-Leonard. Leonard tried to clip off work with his back to the ropes, or Jersey Joe Walcott versus Rocky Marciano. You can fight with your back to the ropes, but it makes judging murky, which could be to your benefit. But if you actually want to win some rounds, make sure that what you do happens where everyone can see it. And ideally what the opponent does happens over in a corner where no one really sees what's going on. So I really like that. And his circling back out to the center of the ring was really excellent. Later in the fight, when Beterbiev was slowing down, he was able to see the right hands coming along the ropes, and he would slip deep underneath them and turn Beterbiev around. There were a couple of beautiful 180 turns where he put Bivol in the corner. Sorry, he put Beterbiev in the corner. So I will say Beterbiev was not able to get his two-handed hitting going that much. He was doing some like flurries of short blows to punctuate with big blows along the fence. So just, you know, pop, 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 bang. Classic, but... And he'd shift through the southpaw to do that too. He was just sort of chasing Bivol when Bivol was covering up. But his left hand, when he sunk it to the body, it looked really good, and he just didn't get to it much. In the first fight, he landed some really nice left uppercuts on the inside, which might have been why Bivol was circling constantly one way in this fight. So I thought this was fantastic. I think I felt like Bivol did more in the early going and the late going, where Beterbiev had a very strong middle portion. I think if you tallied up the rounds where Bivol was doing better, I felt like Bivol deserved the win this time. But I've spoken to people who thought that Beterbiev did better this time than he did the first time. I mean, that's the level we're talking about. I was having to think about that. I was listening to Dan Carlin, because I hadn't listened to any hardcore history in a while. I was listening to him talk about Philip II and Alexander the Great. And I was thinking, when you're living through great fighters, you've always got this, well, hold on. They're not as great as so-and-so or as great as Muhammad Ali or whatever. You know, we are living through an all-time great resume in Alexander Usyk. And I feel like at every stage, certainly I've been like, well, let's see how this goes. And I thought about that because obviously with Alexander the Great, you don't know you're living through the great for the first half of his life. And of course, he came after his father, Philip II, who did most of the work. So you're going to be even less inclined to believe that he's going to be the greatest. But I feel like I do that a lot. Sometimes I take stock of what I've watched and I go, oh, hang on a minute. I might be watching like an all-time great fighter, all-time great rivalry. These fights have both been not necessarily like barn burners, but both of them in different ways have been high, high level technique, high level tactics, and also high level athleticism, because I think that a lot of what got Bivol through the late part of this fight was just being in better condition or lasting longer. You know, I don't think Beterbiev was a slouch in his conditioning or anything like that, because he's never been anything but professional. But that's, you know, the old Muhammad Ali quote, you've got to have the skill and the will, but the will has to be stronger than the skill. And that, again, could be the age difference, because now I'm going, you know, we want the third fight. Everyone wants the third fight. Everyone except the WBC, who now want Bivol to defend all the belts again, or at least the WBC belt, against David Benavidez. It's an odd one because Benavidez is sort of owed. He had the WBC interim super middleweight title, which was like, that should line you up Canelo, because Canelo had all the belts. And the WBC made no pressure on Canelo to get Canelo to fight him. Canelo was doing off doing bollocks with one of the Charlos and all that stuff. Canelo picks who he wants, but the WBC are happy to have their belt on Canelo for some reason. So David Benavidez has been screwed by like super fights or super fighters picking their own fights in the past. But you do feel like, oh, come on, David, step aside. Could you take a large sum of money to step aside, please? Because we want to see this one again. And then I'm thinking like, but Beterbiev is 41 or whatever. We might have seen the best Beterbiev come in on the first fight. And even if he's getting better tactically or he makes better reads of Bivol and he gets more used to Bivol's style, he's still an aging athlete and Bivol is very much in his prime. So all that is to say, I really loved this fight and I think you should watch it. And maybe at some point I'll write something about it because there are so many little technical details like I talked about that I really loved. You right now could work on the Bivol point stealer, round stealer. Jab, right straight to the body, left hook to the head, right straight. If you get good at doing that, and the left hook is real long, like palm away from you long. If you get good at that, you can steal rounds. It's like someone was telling me that they just copy combinations that they see Yuki Oza doing in sparring, and then they do them in their sparring. And because most people spar at regular gyms for the regular people where defense is not super slick, people will go, damn, you're really good at kickboxing. He was like, no, I just steal stuff of Yuki Oza. But anyway, all that is to say, brilliant fight. Go watch it. Worth the 18 quid or whatever I paid for it, and probably worth the $0 that statistically you will probably pay for it. There was talk about changing the arena to a smaller one, which was very weird because this was in Saudi Arabia. So that would be really, like, why would you admit that you're, I mean, why would you even need to? It's Saudi Arabia. You could just, surely you could just hire people to sit in the stands if you wanted to put on a good impression. But famously, like, these things look like massive successes because they're huge to us, people who follow fighting, but they aren't necessarily huge, huge, huge. I saw someone saying that, like, the boxing fan base is baked in. Like, the mega fights and the regular fights don't actually do that much difference in buys and tickets sold. Unless it's something stupid like, you know, Mayweather-Pacquiao, which you'll remember had like the best part of 10 years as a build, or McGregor-Mayweather, which again was like a freak show. It wasn't a regular Mayweather fight. It wasn't a regular McGregor fight. And you had the cultural sensation of McGregor going on around that too. But to see the two best guys in the world do it at a high level, that for us is like the biggest treat. And that's what the Saudis have been doing. And for most people, that's like, yeah, does that not happen all the time? So we got a card this weekend. I'll briefly touch on it because it's not a strong card. I keep changing my mind when I look at it because there are some matchups that are obviously horrible, like Cody Brundage versus Julian Marquez is the co-main event. I believe Cody Brundage is on. Did he pick up a win? Yeah, he has one win over Zach Greece and another win over Jacob Malkoon by illegal move. Jacob Malkoon was kicking his ass and elbowed him in the back of the head, and they immediately gave him the DQ. So he's got one win in 7 fights. And he's fighting Julian Marquez, who hasn't won a fight since he asked for a date with Miley Cyrus back in 2021. And that was over Sam Alvey on a 6-fight losing streak or whatever. This is your co-main event. So that's dog shit. But then you'll see people you know who are good. You'll go, oh, hang on, Charles Johnson's on this card. But he's fighting a largely unknown guy with one fight in the UFC. And you're like, didn't Charles Johnson just knock out Joshua Van in like the most impressive win of his career? What's he doing? Not even the curtain jerker, the second fight on the card against a dangerous unknown guy. If that's not the UFC trying to screw him, Charles Johnson, what are your management doing, mate? I think sometimes fighters, in their machismo to not turn down fights, do dumb things for their career. So anyway, yeah, there's some names, but they're in weird fights, is what I meant to say. Manel Kapp versus Asu Almabayev is your main event. Almabayev, I was just watching him win over Nicolau. It was boring, but again, a lot of that is Nicolau. He was allergic to putting on a fun fight. He's got 4 wins in the UFC now. Obviously, his first one, he choked out Odie Osborne, which was a really freakish height mismatch because Almabayev's like 5'4", and Odie Osborne's like the height of a regular person. Since then, it's been decisions, including over CJ Vergara, who is not very good. But he's fun. He's working with Hooft on his striking, I believe. Throws the odd wheel kick. He's mainly about the wrestling. He's got some good trips. He's got some good... he's got a nice head outside single, crackdown, all that stuff. He's fighting Manel Kapp, who... I was listening to Heavy Hands and they were saying, like, we don't want to talk about Manel Kapp again because it's been done so many times because he either shows up... He either shows up and you're like, oh, wow, what an impressive fighter. I hope to see more of him. Or he shows up and he doesn't fight. Or more often, he gets booked for like a main event and then it falls through. Now, granted, the one against Royval, that was this one. Royval pulled out and is still going ahead because he accepted a replacement at the last minute, and it's a pretty dangerous last minute replacement. I mean, you can't think of two more different fighters than Brandon Royval. Lanky striker who falls over on banana peels all the time and has no interest in taking you down. And Almabayev, whose whole stated purpose in this fight will be to take Karp down. But yes, he's incredibly frustrating. He looked decent in his counter-wrestling and his counter-grappling against Makhachev. We're a long way from when Kyoji Horiguchi just manhandled him for fun. But headlining a card with Manel Kapp just seems like a big risk. Actually, it's not a risk because no one is watching or cares, but it seems like it could go badly viewer-wise. If Almabayev wins, at least you've got something new going on, I suppose. Cody Brundage versus Julian Marquez, of course. Nasrat Haqparast, Esteban Ribovic. Yeah, fun enough. William Gomez is on this card, and he's another one whose record is much better than where he is on this card. However, in the UFC, you're talking about a guy with 4 wins, 3 decisions, 2 split, 1 majority, and 1 finish by kick to the groin that was misinterpreted as a body kick. Oh, actually, no, I think they even said at the time it was a groin kick, but he can't continue, so they somehow called it a TKO. No idea why Yanis Gamouri hasn't appealed that. Oh, he was in Paris, where I don't even know if they have a commission, but crazy. William Gomez is one of the most boring fighters alive. Very polished striker, great sense of distance, zero sense of urgency, seemingly zero desire to want to hurt someone, except when he kicked that dude in the groin and he was like, oh my God, I can't believe I've TKO'd this guy. And he's fighting Haider Amil, who I've watched in the UFC twice and can't remember. Austin Lane's on this card, and I was heavyweight Austin Lane. And I was going, how is he still in the UFC? And then I checked, and he's actually got a win since being easily knocked out twice in a row. Who's that win over? Rebelis Despan. I forgot that even happened. In my head, Rebelis Despan got his hype train derailed by Waldo Ocasio-Cortez, and then he was kicked out of the UFC. In reality, he then fought Austin Lane, a guy who is only going to stand and kick with him, supposedly the best kicker in the world at heavyweight, and Rebelis Despan got jobbed out by one of the worst fighters on the roster. Anything else good on here? Ricardo Ramos versus Chepe Mariscal is good. Chepe Mariscal, scrappy is how I describe him, but he obviously derailed the Morgan Charrier hype train two fights ago. Beat Jack Jenkins before that and Trevor Peake. And he just beat Damon Jackson. I mean, Damon Jackson's pretty washed at this point, but four-fight winning streak in the UFC, not bad. And again, that Charrier fight, split decision because it was a big action fight and lots was going on, but I was very impressed with him in that. And he's fighting Ricardo Ramos, who is my boy. You know, he's pretty bad at doing the right things. He's pretty bad at actually getting two wins on the trot. But he'll forever be my boy because he does fun stuff sometimes. I was hearing people disparage his wrestling, though. And like sometimes Ricardo Ramos, he's got the Patricio Pitbull thing. He'll pick a fight and he'll just turn up, hit the clinch and inside trip the guy 200 times. And you'll go, oh, when did he learn to wrestle? And then in the next fight, he won't even attempt to take the guy down at all. But he's not on a great run. He got finished by Jordan and Rosa, both by guillotine in the first round. And then he managed to scrape a split over Josh Koulibaly. Fingers crossed he's able to stay in the UFC. Though if he went to PFL, in their featherweight division, he could win himself not $1 million anymore, but certainly some money. Douglas Silva, Dion Drodge versus John Castaneda. That, you know, old man Dion Drodge, who's still a bit of a machine, versus Sexy Mexi. What's not to like? Andrea Lee's on the card, so someone will say something racist, I'm sure. And that's about it. But yeah, I mean, it's Ramazan Temerov is the guy taking on Charles Johnson. And I watched his first fight in the UFC, kind of skewed because he was fighting CJ Vergara, who's not very good. People fetishize flyweights in a weird way, where they assume that the lower the weight you get, the more technical everyone is, and the better standard the fights will be. But really, it's more of a bell curve of like, where are most normal people weight-wise? What weight can most normal people make? So obviously, the number of flyweights in the world is going to be like the number of heavyweights in the world. There's not going to be very many of them, good fighters. And that's why we get like CJ Vergara, Shannon Ross, Jesus Aguilar the other week. Lacerda had six fights in the UFC. There are quite a few very sloppy flyweights fighting in the UFC right now. But the way he knocked him down was pretty cool. Temerov, this is. Threw a jab, overhand, weaved and shifted at the same time to land the left hook. It was the old Vovchanchin, the Dillashaw Barao. Someone did it the other day and I mentioned it. Was it? Who was it? Shit, it's gone. But just the other day we were talking about this weaving left hook and Temerov landed it very well. Another Uzbek, I believe. Yes, they're all stumpy and explosive over there, it turns out. Or at least their fighters are. But I think there's enough on that card that there'll be interesting stuff happening. I'll be surprised if it's awful. This is like a prime candidate for people to be like, sometimes the cards with no names on have the best fights. And I would agree, actually, like this could be a pretty good card. It's just that The good named fighters on there are sort of like, what are you doing? You're not really achieving anything winning this fight, and you're putting quite a lot on the line losing this fight. And then there's a load of slop like Cody Brundage versus Julian Marquez. No wins since 2021 is wild. But anyway, I really just wanted to talk about Better Beer versus Bivol 2 because it was fantastic. I'm your boy, Jack Slag. You're my boy because you're here. Oh, I forgot to mention, next week, what I've been working on is that I'm working on a Pereira Filthy Casuals Guide, because I haven't done a Filthy Casuals Guide in a while. I'm really not going to do huge scope, just going to keep it to a couple of things he does that I can talk about and make look good. But I thought it was a good one to do because it's really unrewarding to do in-depth stuff on Malcoon or whoever and not get any views. But my Jose Aldo one has like 800,000 views on. So it's always a good way to get new views into the channel and to say, look, I do a podcast and we talk about fights and there's more to it than just screaming at a knockout or whatever. But yeah, so if you see that go up, immediately share it for me. Cheers. But you will, because you're my boy. Sexy Mexi bless.